This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Wow. Well, as I said, we are in Clearwater, Florida, and we are heading into hurricane season, so I am very happy to welcome to the program today somebody who knows a bit about them. Tristram Corton has written a fantastic book called Into the Storm, Two Ships, a Deadly Hurricane, and an Epic Battle for Survival. Hi, Tristram. Are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Wow. Oh, this is one exciting book. I know it is nonfiction, but it is so exciting. It reads like fiction, and it just, you did an amazing job here of bringing these storms, these two ships, and the storm alive. So let's start there. Where did you get this idea for this wonderful book?
Well, thank you very much for all of that, by the way. The idea came just from the events. I mean, one of the ships that I write about is called El Faro. It was circuiting between Jacksonville, Florida, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, sort of supplying the island with its everything from cars to groceries. And it disappeared in this hurricane, and that was national news. Everybody, the New York Times, all the network news stations were covering it daily. It was a gripping event for the country. And I've always been fascinated. I grew up on the water and have, you know, interacted a lot with it and know its power and am scared of its power. So I became fascinated, wondering how such a big ship, this was nearly 800 feet long, could just disappear. And I started going through, and I saw it. I'm a freelance journalist, and this was being covered by all the big newspapers and television stations, so there wasn't a lot of opportunity for me to say something new. But I began looking at the Coast Guard press releases and, you know, wondering if I wanted to attend some of the briefings. And I saw a small little release on a rescue the same day that the El Faro disappeared. And it was about this cargo ship from Miami that did the same thing. It supplied Haiti regularly with groceries and cars and bicycles. And it sank the same day, but they were able to get a Mayday out, and a Coast Guard helicopter crew conducted a mission that took them all night long in the middle of a hurricane. They dropped a rescue swimmer into 20-foot seas, and he spent hours upon hours rescuing the crew of this ship one by one from a life raft.
Well, they are two parallel stories, and as I said, you have written them in such a wonderful way, and that's why Lee Child has given you one of the best blurbs I've ever seen him give somebody, because he says, spectacular in every way, an intense, immersive, deep dive into a wild, dangerous, and unknown world, written with the pace and appeal of a great thriller. And he is right, because it was a wonderful idea to take the two different ships and the different captains and crew and really bring them, to the reader in such a way that we really, first of all, just like in a novel, we're like, we get so excited. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. Most of us don't know the who's going to survive, who's not going to survive. So it's a thriller, and it's just brilliantly done.
Well, thank you. Again, thank you very much. And that was kind of Lee Child to write that. It's true. I can only take so much credit because these are real events. They really did happen. And I feel extremely fortunate to have been able to write about, you know, these people who, in all the different facets of the story, from the Coast Guard end, the Minouche end, El Faro end, you know, there were tremendous displays of leadership in the face of, you know, imminent danger and bravery, to, you know, facing the elements.
Well, I love sea stories, but like you, I've always been really frightened. I was born on the shores of Lake Superior, so I've witnessed huge, terrible storms, and I've heard, you know, stories about ships going down all my life, and there's always that in the back of my mind, you know, that it does happen. And so when I was reading this book, I was thinking, you captured their dialogue. So you did a lot of research here. You really got to know some of the people involved and to understand the type of people who are on these ships and who risk their lives. Most people don't understand that this is a very risky job to take on.
Right. Well, I mean, we take for granted that we'll go to the store and there will be a new iPhone on the shelf waiting for us, or a computer, or jeans, or shirts. All of that stuff is shipped here on cargo ships. And it doesn't magically appear. It's not airlifted here. That's way too expensive. It crosses the open and very wild oceans of this world. And these are working class men. They're not doing it to be heroes, but it does. I mean, for me, it definitely made me want to sort of reflect on what I consume and what it takes to get it here, and the nod of thanks to these guys who spend their lives doing this for us. Yeah, and I also wanted to say again, and I cannot take credit for this, but so with El Faro's situation, it sank, but they were able to recover this Voyage data recorder, so you have 26 hours of conversation recorded on the bridge. It's like the airplane cockpit black box. And so you're as a writer, I'm able to replicate exactly what they're doing and saying at the moment it's happening, which was a tremendous. I mean, it was tragic to read that, because you read it right to the end, to the final scream. But it was a tremendous tool in order to tell this tale and you know, honor these guys who lost their lives.
Well, with the Titanic, we had a few cables coming out, and here you had, as you said, 26 hours of tape to go through, and it must have been hard to listen to their words. But what you've done by taking their words and making a really compelling story out of it, I think it's very important work.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things also I really enjoyed, you've obviously done a lot of research into the subject, and I enjoyed your section there where you talk about really hurricanes and where the word comes from. And so tell us some of that, because I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I did too. So I spent so much time on it. But I mean, your show is for writers, so I will say that, you know, as I was conceiving of this, how to put this all together, I decided I really wanted to make the hurricane a character. It deserved as much, you know, time spent on it as I would trying to flesh out the personality of a captain. And I can do that thanks to the National Hurricane Center, which keeps an archive of all its advisory and discussions and forecasts related to this hurricane, as well as they put out a very detailed, you know, quote, after-action report on it. And you see this storm develop and then defy all the predictions and all the forecasts that were laid out for it. Most of the hurricanes we get, the vast majority of them, come from warm breezes off the coast of Africa that travel you know, and become a low pressure system in the Atlantic, especially when it hits the tropical waters where the warm water fuels the big storm. But this one popped up sort of north of the Bahamas, between the Bahamas and Bermuda, and instead of going west and then curving north, it went straight south. So it was kind of hard for forecasters to get a read on it. And you see it develop over time very quickly. It developed so quickly because the water was the warmest on record for that time of year in that location. And that just let it, I mean, it went in, I think, 6 hours, it went from a category one to a category, from a tropical storm to a category two or three. It just blew off.
Now, that was in the year 2015, in September 2015. Was that a big hurricane year? Were a lot of hurricanes predicted that year?
No, it wasn't. It had calmed down a bit from, there was a previous run of a very active season we'd had, and then this was a particularly calm. And it didn't even make a landfall. It wasn't a hurricane people are going to remember because it didn't, you know, batter the coast. It did hook up with a low pressure system over the south that caused some, and sort of that low pressure system sucked a lot of the moisture out, and there was historic flooding in the Carolinas. But otherwise, yeah, you wouldn't have noticed this hurricane or that year. But you know, we have a warming climate, and the scientists are predicting that there's, you know, that's going to impact hurricanes. They're going to be stronger, probably not more of them than we're seeing. There might be fewer, but they'll be stronger. And there are other interesting things that scientists have been, since you asked about science, that have been noting that are going to play a role in this as well. Which all over the world, scientists have been recording higher and higher wave heights, which may be a result of you know, the increased volume of water from thermal expansion and from the melting ice cap.
Now, when the hurricane, who's the one who gives out the warnings, the hurricane warnings?
National Hurricane
Center. So the National Hurricane, they supply this information to all the ships, and of course, not all ships are as equipped to get. To get the messages, is that true?
I think commercial vessels are all required to have a kind of a rudimentary printer that can print out these warnings. They're called Inmarsat C terminals. But both of these ships had that access to the latest information as soon as they're being released. But in El Faro's case, the captain was relying on a fancier weather forecasting system that had a fatal flaw. He was looking at one called the Bon Voyage system. And the Bon Voyage system took the NHC forecast and augmented it with other information. And that took a few hours. And by the time the captain received it, it was several hours old. But he didn't know that. For some crazy reason, he hadn't been briefed on that. And he was looking, so when he was looking at the storm's movement, they were 6 to 13 hours old.
Wow, and so he's headed in the wrong direction.
Well, he's headed towards the storm. He was always going to head towards the storm, but he thought he could just skirt south of it by about 60 miles, which is still a crazy close distance from a major hurricane. Most of the captains I talk to who sail commercial vessels like this say they like to keep 200 to 300 miles away from a low pressure system, let alone a hurricane. And he was sailing towards it, and he thought he could just, you know, the last minute skirt around it, but he was off by 40 miles. So when they ended up within 20 miles of the eye, maybe closer.
Wow. Well, from that, of course, you've created this story. You obviously did a lot of research, and you've met a lot of sailors who I think, you know, have helped you understand how things work on a ship.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, I was able to track down Captain Helera of the Manouche. And you had mentioned this earlier, the difference between the two captains, or that, you know, that you see in the profile of these two captains. And it didn't really emerge until I had done all my research and interviews, and actually started the book, to be honest, that the contrast between the two captains determines the fates of those vessels. And it really becomes a compare and contrast situation, and you can see tragedy on one side and you know, a success on the other. But Captain Davidson from El Faro was over reliant on technology. I mean, both of these captains have been career mariners, commercial mariners, their entire lives. And sailed all over the world. But in this instance, at this point in his career, Captain Davidson was a little overly reliant on this technology. He had also developed a reputation as being a stateroom captain, a captain who, you know, stayed in his office on the ship and monitored things, and then would come up to the bridge and monitor things. But he didn't walk the ship. He wasn't known as someone who, you know, listened to the crew and knew his ship like you would know your left arm. And in fact, in the tragedy of El Faro, his second officer and second mate and third mate, both confronted him in the middle of the night at different times on their watches and asked him to reconsider, because the information coming in showed them on this dangerous track. And he looked at his computer in his stateroom and said, no, we're going to be fine. We're going to be south of it pretty soon. And he was dead wrong.
Well, that's why this book is a nail biter, because we don't, you know, it is exciting. And you have just captured wonderful dialogue. And with the dialogue and your descriptions, you just have us there on the ships, and we are going through the storm. And I wanted to ask you something. You know, of course, the hero out of this too is the Coast Guard. You know, we have the U.S. Coast Guard, and are really quite amazing, the work that they do. And tell us a little bit, because you've been able to visit with the Coast Guard and to learn something about the work that they do.
Yes, absolutely. And you're in Clearwater,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is where the air station Clearwater is, where these Coast Guardsmen are based. They were on a 2-week deployment out into a remote Bahamian island called Great Anagua, and it's where the Coast Guard maintains a 2-helicopter base. And, you know, so I interviewed all 4 members of this helicopter crew that went out. And obviously they're all highly trained and very technically proficient. I mean, there were 2 pilots, an aviation mechanic, and a rescue swimmer. And they all had very specific jobs, and they knew them in and out. And these were tax dollars well spent. But the rescue swimmer who went into the water, his tale's very interesting, because a lot of people might not know that this is the service's elite operative, the equivalent of the Navy SEALs for the Navy, etc. They will start a class with like 24. They're training, and I visited the training facility in North Carolina. They'll start a class with 24, 25 candidates, and 3 will graduate. There's intense conditioning. There's also a lot of psychological pressure put on them, because, as the trainers told me, they can't afford to have somebody who isn't completely prepared to drop into the most dangerous situation possible to save lives.
Because and a normal person would panic. I mean, it's so frightening to see the sea swirling, and to even I can't even imagine jumping into it, let alone doing it over and over and over again.
Right, and they live for that. They always there's a funny scene where they you know the storm is coming. They're not going to go on patrol. This is before they know they're flying out to rescue anybody. And they're and a couple of them take a truck into town, and the hurricane is coming, and the waves are crashing over this, crashing so hard they're sending spray over this 200-foot lighthouse tower on the island. And the rescue swimmer turns to one of the pilots and says, "Sir, this may sound crazy, but I really feel like going swimming right now." And you know, back on base, they were saying, "Oh yeah, that's the rescue swimmers. They're always, always wanting to get in the water, no matter what." So, but thank God we have them because you know they do tremendous good in this world.
You know, I was wondering, you know, is there any other country that has a Coast Guard like ours? I can't imagine any Coast Guard along any other border that shoreline that has these type of people.
You know, that's a very good question. I have not done any kind of compare and contrast to other nations, but I know that there are Coast Guards that, you know, are routinely rescue people all over the Mediterranean and South America. And I don't know what their rescue tour programs are like. I don't think we are unique in that we can find individuals and train them, you know, to jump into danger like that in order to save lives. When these guys come out of their training, they're like they're as valuable as professional athletes are. You know, and they're having a hard time finding enough people to fill their ranks because you know, only certain individuals who can graduate from those schools.
Well, and they are very just as our Navy SEALs and our Army Rangers are very, very precious and very important people. They probably don't get paid what professional athletes get paid, and they do this tremendous work to save so many lives. They are quite amazing, and this book I think is a real testament to the wonderful work that the Coast Guard does and the wonderful work that these rescue swimmers. I had really understood. I mean, you see it sometimes in a movie, you see them jumping in, but you don't understand that this is a real career choice. You know?
Yeah.
You sort of think it's just somebody who just, you know, decided to jump in. But this is have this as a career choice, that is something pretty amazing. Listen, I have to take a commercial break. Will you hold on? Because I want to talk to you more about hurricanes. Absolutely. And more about the research you did. So just hold on a short commercial break and we'll be right back, okay?
No problem.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
My Pillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And I am back with my guest, Tristram. That's a mouthful, Tristram. Do your friends call you? What do your friends call you?
They call me Tris.
Tris.
You're welcome to call me Tris.
Okay, I'll call you Tris. Because it's hard to say it three times in a row. And the last name is Corton with a K. So I just want to tell people that so that they can find your book, and it's called Into the Storm, Two Ships, a Deadly Hurricane, and an Epic Battle for Survival. This is a wonderful, wonderful book, and I, you know, living here in Florida, of course, surrounded by the water and the hurricane season coming up, oh boy, we're not looking forward to, because last year when we had the Hurricane Irma here, we lost our electricity for 7 days, I think 6 hours and 22 minutes, something. We were counting, and it was quite horrible. So we're not looking forward to that.
No. I have a little footnote about Hurricane Irma. I was still writing the book when it came, and we had to evacuate our home here on Miami Beach. And we have a small dog. I have two daughters. My wife is a nurse and was on shift, and they allowed us to evacuate to the hospital, which is had backup power and was a hardened building. But they wouldn't take the dog. So my plan was to drive into a parking garage, park, and leave the dog at the last minute. And then I got in there, and it was open on three sides, but very solid. And the storm started coming. And I thought, you know, I'm writing a book about hurricanes.
I should
take this opportunity to stay and watch the hurricane. So I stayed in the parking garage with my dog for 2 days and set up my computer and pulled up right to the edge of the thing and you know, typed my impressions and what I saw, as well as, more research and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm sure your wife really appreciated that. Really, I'm sure she said, oh, yeah, dear, just jump right into that hurricane. We wanted your book to be as realistic as possible. You know, why not just get on a ship, you know, right in the middle of a hurricane? You know, wives sometimes don't appreciate things their husbands do. No. So, but you survived it.
I've got a very understanding wife.
Well, yeah. And you survived it. And maybe that's one of the reasons that you write so beautifully about the hurricane, because you really do take us into it. And we really feel like we're you know, right there. And the winds are pummeling us, and the rain is slapping us in the face. And so it worked for you.
I don't want to do it again.
No, and definitely not on a ship. Don't get this idea. Of course, when they film this, and they recreate this whole thing, then you can be one of the you can take a part there, you know, and be one of the ship's crew.
And right, do a cameo. Is it the crew member?
You know, Clive Cussler. He was telling me he likes to do. You know, he does, when he was on my program, he was saying that one of the things he likes to do, he always puts himself in a book. He'll write his own character into a book. And then if they do a movie, he always wants to be, you know, just have that little, sort of like Alfred Hitchcock kind of thing. So I see this, of course, we all know, anybody, I think the minute we read this, and combined with Lee Child, wonderful blurb, because this is a wonderful endorsement. We know that it's going to be a movie at some point. It's going to be a very exciting movie, and so you'll be able to be on the ship. Oh, you know, while I'm thinking about it, I would like to come on. I'll be one of the crew members, too. Okay. That's the only way I really want to be on a ship in a hurricane is if they're filming it, and they've got the safety ropes on us all, right?
Right, right, right. Exactly.
But it,
yeah, I'm, well, from your lips, that it be made into a movie. I mean, I think it would be an exciting one. But I gotta say, a lot of people are saying, "Oh, that's gonna be a movie." Their first reaction is, "You've written a book. That sounds great. Sounds like it's gonna be a movie." I'm very happy with having written a book. I think that's a huge accomplishment. And you know, we all know books are better than the movies anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think Lee Child might agree with you on that, because there's nothing like a book. But one of the nice things about having a movie is that people then will come back and read the book. You know, more people will read it. This is one of the problems. Now, this is your first book, right? Your first?
Yeah.
Okay. So what happens is you have this window of opportunity of a month or 2 months where people will notice you and have you do interviews and talk about your book. But then after a while, nobody talks about it, and you don't have these opportunities. The beautiful thing about when a book is made into a movie is that you have a big new run of opportunities to promote your book. So I always, you know, I wrote screenplays, so I always look at it from the other point of view of, you know, I know that I prefer the books. I rarely have I seen a movie that I like better than the book. But I know that it is so helpful to an author to have a movie done about your book because,
No doubt. I mean, the cultural conversation today largely takes place around movies.
Exactly. And the nice thing, the wonderful thing about this book, I mean, as we said, it's nonfiction, but because you are so good at writing dialogue and so good at capturing the characters that I'm sure that if you haven't already, they've already been offering you deals to write more books. Of course, you'll get sometimes what happens. Well, it's sort of like you might be the next Clive Cussler. You know, you're going to be doing books about the sea forever. So I don't know, you know, but sometimes they typecast you as an author. They'll say, okay, well, you wrote one book about the sea. Now every book you write is going to have to be about the sea kind of thing.
Yeah.
But,
well, listen, thank you for all of that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, again, from your lips, God's ears, but
it has happened actually on this show because I did find an author who wrote just short stories, and the minute I found her, I said, this has to be a movie, and she's gotten a movie deal. So things happen, you see, and the thing is, when I read a book, because of my experience as a script writer, if I see a book as a movie, if I can, I just visualize it, and I actually, as happened with this book, I'm reading it and I forget that. I mean, I'm so immersed in the book, I see it in my head, and so I know it's going to be a great book, great film.
Well, thank you.
And the nice thing, the nice thing is that, you know, your dialogue is crisp. What you write is crisp, and from you know, what happens so often when they take a book, one of the big problems with adapting a book, and I've done it a couple of times, is that there is a lot of dialogue that you really don't want. You really have to get rid of. And then the authors, you know, start crying and sobbing, and they sit on the floor and bang their heads against the wall because you've taken out the words. But you have developed a nice talent for good, smart dialogue, and it's there. And some script writer is going to say, oh, thank you, I love you.
Yeah, I hope so. I do hope it gets made into a movie, and there are other opportunities to do stories like this. What helps probably with that, so I've been a journalist a long time, and yes, that doesn't matter. Plenty of journalists write dialogue that is too long for scriptwriters and whatnot, but I have done radio and radio reporting, and that you really have to pare it down to its essence. You've got a short amount of time, and you're letting the word speak. You have to pick the word properly, so you develop a more of an eye for
You have done it, and you know the wonderful thing. I always love books that are based in Florida or around Florida, or talk about Florida, and so I really. When I read this book, I really got in my head. I started realizing how very much hurricanes have impacted the entire history of Florida.
Oh, yeah,
it's amazing. I had never really put it in perspective before that everything changed here depending on what country was coming at us and what hurricanes hit.
Right, that was very interesting to learn all about that. The whole Caribbean, the whole. Colonization of the Caribbean, when all the European powers were fighting for control over over these trade routes, was largely formed by hurricanes. You know, the Dutch would take on the Spanish and a hurricane would come on and wipe out their fleet. Or the Spanish would take on the British and the same thing would happen. And Florida itself is, you know, largely, you know, owes its early history to hurricanes that benefited the Spanish, as they were taking on the French, the two nations that set up colonies, and they were at war. They were, you know, fighting each other for control of this peninsula. And the Spanish sailed on the French and were scattered by a hurricane. The French tried to counterattack, were scattered by a hurricane. And then the Spanish counterattacked again, but this time going over land, and were able to catch the weakened French and up there in Jacksonville and St. John River.
Now, it is. It's really, and I also didn't realize how, when you write about it, how there's so many shipwrecks out there that we have not discovered yet.
Right. Right. That would be fun.
Absolutely. Now, what is the worst hurricane we've had here? Do you know?
It would have been, well, here meaning Florida?
Yeah, in Florida.
Well, that's a good question. So there are different ways. There's the loss of life, and there is they also measure it by damage, by how much it costs to rebuild from it. I'm not going to be able to say off the top of my head which is the worst one. Maria was so. What you have is Maria last year. Was the strongest Atlantic hurricane ever. And a close second was, I believe, Irma. And then you had these anomalous ones like Ophelia, which occurred not here, but it occurred in the sort of the middle of the Atlantic and went east instead of west, which was really bizarre. So they're acting very strangely these days. But which is what the scientists had predicted, that we would have more Category 4s and 5s developed. But and then the year that Joaquin occurred, about 2 weeks later, in off Mexico, was the strongest hurricane ever recorded, Patricia, with 200 mile per hour wind. It didn't make landfall at that intensity, but it still hit the hit the record book.
Now, of course, we were talking about the Coast Guard and. I didn't realize that it was formed so long ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting to learn about the history of the Coast Guard as well. Yeah. So, as I write in the book, you know, and the armed services are pretty straightforward, right? The Navy is on the water, the Army on the land. But the Coast Guard had this sort of, was on this threshold of land and water, and it didn't, and nobody thought to just make a Coast Guard. It happened because in early America, the ports needed, ships that could scare away pirates, but also collect taxes on the boats coming in for trade, doing trade. And then we also had a light, and then years later we had developed a lighthouse service where lighthouses would be set up and we wanted to make sure they were maintained and operated to to warn ships about rocky shores. And, you know, so all these different services, I mean, the first one was called the Revenue Cutter Service, and then the lighthouses, and then a life-saving station. So these were all separate. So then they're developed life-saving stations, which were set up and usually manned by volunteers, and they would go out when a ship did wreck, and they would row out and or try and throw lines to the ship so that people could make it back to shore. And then this is in the 1800s, and then finally the government just rolled them all up into one entity, and that's our U.S. Coast Guard.
And they are really quite amazing. I still don't know why they took down all the lighthouses, because I thought the lighthouse idea was nice, but I don't know, they all disappeared.
Well, they use automatically operated.
I know, but then I thought lighthouses are much
better. Right, weren't they? Oh, absolutely. They're you know, part of our history and the romance of them, too. You know, to be on this little rocky outcropping, shining a light into the dark.
Exactly, exactly. One of the things, when I found it interesting, did people realize what a hurricane was?
That was interesting to learn as well. So you have to realize that before the era of airplanes and satellites, we had no way of knowing that they were, a vortex wind, a circular storm. It must have just seemed like, you know, pure chaos just descending on you and then going. But archaeologists found in the Caribbean islands, where they worship a god who was known variously as Huracan, and they would carve these stone tributes, and it showed, you know, like a center face and then two flailing arms, but the arms were going in a counterclockwise direction, much like the wind pattern of a hurricane. And in fact, it looks exactly like the current day's hurricane symbol that the NHC will put out, you know, the center and then the two arms around it. And they don't know how they could have known what hurricanes were. There was speculation that they saw the pattern of destruction and realized how it moved, which was, in fact, the earliest indication when Westerners determined what hurricanes were was a man in Connecticut who noticed that the trees on the east side of the path of destruction, you know, fell to the north, and the ones on the west side fell to the south, and he realized it was a circular motion.
So we get the name hurricane from this Indian or Native Central American,
yep.
Caribbean, yeah,
yep. From the Caribo Amaro Indians, absolutely.
And who was called Huracan?
Yeah. Huracan, and yeah.
Okay.
The name from that.
So that's what we call our storms here. And yeah. What are the names for storms in other places? What do they call their big storms?
In the eastern Pacific, they're called typhoons, and then in the Indian Ocean and parts of the western Pacific, they are called cyclones. And these are all just regional names, but the main scientific name is a tropical cyclone.
Now,
so the big generic name.
And I found the most fascinating. And so isn't this the wonderful thing about becoming a writer? You start on a subject, you don't know everything about it, and then you start doing research and you find one thing after another that just, it sort of gives you, it tickles a pin. You get so excited, you find something new. And I did not know this about the Mongolian Emperor Kublai Khan. Tell us about that. I thought that was fascinating.
That's another another example of how history was changed by cyclones. So Kublai Khan father was Genghis Khan, and Genghis Khan, you know, overtook Korea, and Kublai Khan, you know, wanted to, you know, build his reputation as well. So he wanted to take over Japan, and he developed a navy, and they set sail from the Korean Peninsula for Japan, and were thwarted by a hurricane. And so they tried again, and they were thwarted by a hurricane again. And the emperor of Japan at the time called these kamikaze, which means divine wind, that they were sent by the gods to protect them. But if that storm had not, that those storms had not occurred, there's a very good chance they'd be speaking, you know, Chinese in Japan right now.
So isn't it wonderful that you learn all of this when you're doing research?
It is wonderful. And as you're asking me questions, I'm realizing it was a while ago that I did all this research, and I'm amazed that I can still pull it out of my brain. I suspect at some point it will, like when I move on to the next thing that requires the space on my hard drive in my head, I'll have to sacrifice some of this information.
Well, no, it's you. What you'll do is you'll build on it, because just these little tidbits. Well, this is why your book is so good, because you manage you have all this nonfiction facts, you know, that are just fascinating. And I love a book where I come away from it and I know more than I knew, you know, before I started reading. So it's there forever, you know. One might be watching television and hear the name Kublai Khan, and you'll say, ah, okay, he wanted to attack Japan, and he was kept off by a divine wind, which is called kamikaze, which, of course, later on, the Japanese used it for something much, much worse. But
right.
It's all of these little things, you know, it's sort of like a big mosaic, a tile by tile. You build this beautiful picture of something, and that's what you've done here with this book. I love all the facts that you weave in, sort of, we'll say, seamlessly. So because if you tell people, okay, you're going to sit down and read a book, a nonfiction book about hurricanes, and learn everything about them, people will say, I'm not going to do it, you know. But
right.
But this book, they'll pick up and they get so excited about the story that they're learning things as they're going along, and that's the mark of a great writer.
Well, thank you again. You're too kind. I did not want to do just a, you know, for lack of a better term, a hurricane or action book, which I saw plenty of when I was doing my research. And we don't, you know, you haven't heard of them because they have a limited, you know, shelf life.
Exactly.
I really did want to do something where you had the context to understand, you know, these events.
Well, I think you have done a beautiful job, Tris. And as I said, I see it in my head as a movie. I want it to be a movie. I hope that they film it here, around here somewhere. And make sure you invite me to the set, because I would love to be one of the crew, you know, one of the crew there getting all buffeted back and forth by these terrible winds. It'll be fun. We'll both be on, you know, we'll do a whole thing, right?
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Talk to Clive Cussler.
Okay, I will. And meanwhile, I want to tell everyone that they should go to wherever books are sold and get this book. It's called Into the Storm. It's really fantastic.
Well, can I say one thing really quick? I'll be in, I know that this is a national program, but for those of your listeners who are in Tampa Clearwater area, I'll be at Inkwood in Tampa Friday, tomorrow.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
Well, that's fantastic. Oh, Inkwood is fantastic. And that is a wonderful opportunity for everyone in our area to come and meet you and to get you to sign the book and ask more questions, because I have a feeling that Tris here is going to be very, very famous. And we're going to have, probably now you're going to get contracts. You'll have a book every year. So I expect you back here in a year. Are you working on your new book already?
No, I'm busy promoting this book and thinking, yeah, trying to think what my next project will be, which will be journalism. You know, probably I'll do some magazine stories.
Okay, well, I have a feeling somebody's going to give you a book contract soon, and we'll have you back. We'll have you back for that. Okay.
All right, I'd love to. Thank
okay, thank you very much. Did you have a website that you want?
I don't really know. I've got an open web, a Facebook page, but no website.
Okay, so they can find you there, and it's Tristram Corton. With a K.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thanks again for being on Joy on Paper today.
No, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Bye-bye. Ooh, I like this book. I like this book. It's really exciting. We don't want to wait until we have a hurricane and we have no electricity and read this book then. You want to get it now and it will set you, what it'll do is, once you read this book, you'll say, okay, I may, I have to get my supplies ready for hurricane season. And that means right now, order those D batteries, because that's the first thing that people run out of here. The stores had no D batteries at all anywhere for 50 miles around when we had our hurricane here. So make sure that you order D batteries today. And have them. I already ordered my D batteries because I'm not. I was a hero of my building because I had D batteries. I was the only person in the building who had D batteries that I could hand out to people to put into their lanterns. So please make sure that you go ahead and do that. And meanwhile, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book or as is going to happen with Tris here. See it on the big screen because this book is going to be made into a film. I am sure of it. And I hope that you will get the book wherever books are sold. And go to Ink tomorrow and see him in right there in Tampa. So what else? Oh, I put Jeffrey Deaver off. I'm going to have him next week. And then I also have some very exciting guests coming up. But remember, Bill Larson is going to be back next month with answers to your legal questions. So if you have an intellectual property question, please go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com. And right there on the front page, I have a form that you can fill in with your question for Bill Larson, and he will answer your intellectual property questions. And there's some really interesting cases that have come up recently, and you want to be aware of what you can copyright and what you can't, because things are getting strange out there. People are trying to copyright words, not books, but actual words, so that you cannot even use the word in your book, which is a very interesting concept. And we'll see what Bill has to say about that idea. And meanwhile, again, make sure that you say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you very much. We had a few switcherounds today, and I really appreciate all the work that Big Ed does for me. And just everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. The most important thing is to be nice, be kind, and read a book, because it helps all those little gray cells in your brain to stay active so that you can then write a book. Bye-bye now.